Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 06-5199. Net from my association of health for Dirk Sixborn, Secretary of Interior L.
On behalf of ourselves, but more on behalf of GSA, we're sorry that there was a water main break and we weren't able to have this scheduled, and we appreciate both sides being willing to reschedule so quickly.
Problem, Your Honor. Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Kirsten Nathanson. I'm appearing on behalf of Appellant National Mining Association, known as NMA. In this case, NMA is challenging the second element of the Secretary's interpretation of the term valid existing rights, also known as VER, as it appears in Section 522E of the Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act of 1977, known as SMCRA. Now we have the acronyms out of the way. The second element of the VER definition, which is also known as the good faith all permits test, or in further shorthand in our briefs as the all permits prong, is contrary to the unambiguous congressional intent to preserve.
Let's talk about that unambiguous congressional intent. In your briefing, you say it's actually a term of art. What is the precise technical meaning of VER?
When we use the argument of the term of art, we're referring to the fact that VER has been used in dozens of congressional enactments prior to SMCRA, and that when it is
any of them used in the way you're arguing now?
Yes, it is used as in a savings clauses to preserve property rights that were obtained under a prior law, preserve them from being impaired or extinguished by the enactment
of the
subsequent law.
So your definition is property rights obtained under a prior law. Is that the term of art?
Yes. Well, and actually, and if we cut to the plain meaning of valid existing rights, the three words, there are three elements that the Secretary actually achieves in the first prong of the VER definition. If you look to the word rights, the Secretary asks, do you own the coal? Second, valid, is your right valid under state law? Meaning, do you have the authority to mine that coal by the method you intend?
Regulation that define under a different statute that uses the term VER. Is there any regulation that defines it the way you're suggesting?
Regulation, not that I'm aware. The prior interpretations of VER are from the Secretary in solicitors' opinions. There are judicial interpretations applying VER clauses.
Well, with respect to the Secretary's interpretation, what's one where they have previously defined VER the way you're defining it? Or actually, where they've ever defined it at all? That is, as an interpretation of a statute.
Well, if you look at we cite in our briefs a 1981 solicitor's opinion in which they're interpreting VER as enacted under FLPMA, the Federal Land Management Policy Act, which was enacted 1 year prior to SMCRA, and in which the Secretary discusses that VER refers to those prior rights.
This is 1981.
It's a 1981 solicitor's opinion.
Right, but there had previously been a regulation under SMCRA which had defined it the way the department is defining it now, right?
No, the 1979 SMCRA regulation did not have the good faith element. They defined it in
But they had more than just property rights.
They defined it to go beyond property rights to
so
the exercise
anything,
the of property
solicitor
rights.
General, the solicitor's interpretation is inconsistent with the previous interpretation of the Secretary.
Well, there was also a 1970 interpretation that is also cited in our briefs.
And what was that under?
The Hobbs decision.
Was that an interpretation of a statute by the Secretary?
That was a decision of the IBLA.
What's the IBLA?
Interpreting someone's rights under the Wilderness,
What's the IBLA?
Act. Pardon me?
What's the IBLA?
I believe it's the Interior Board of Land Appeals.
Are you having trouble hearing me?
A little bit, yes.
Is this on? Okay, so we're both going to have to speak louder.
Right.
Could you just say what you said again?
Sure. On the Interior Board of Land Appeals. Uh-huh. That is the appellate adjudicatory board within the Department of the Interior.
But there is no actual regulation that's inconsistent with this regulation interpreting VER. Is that right?
Regulation, no, not that I'm aware.
Now, there's that Alaska case, right? The Alaska Indian case?
Yes.
Now, that one defined VER as not being a property right, right?
That...
It's not requiring it to be a property right, right?
Well, it was less than a property right. VER right. Has protected a broad spectrum of property and rights.
So that's inconsistent with your view is it's got to be a property right.
Or, well, Your Honor, it's been a property right or an interest in which you have to take several steps to accomplish and vest your right, which is how federal property law in the Western United States has been construed throughout the 19th and early 20th centuries, when the United States was going through the processes of setting up statutory schemes that would transfer property, that would transfer vested rights, you know, from the United States to private citizens, and they would set up statutory processes with various steps that you have to go along the way to accomplish that. And for instance, in the Alaska case, there was a special two-step process a municipality had to go through. And the municipality had completed the first step, and then there was really no discretion for the United States to take that land back under the second step. Regardless of what happened in that second phase, the municipality would maintain or would hold the land.
We don't have a case in which the agency decided it wasn't a property right and only a property right, and the court said it was, or even the other way around. We don't have any case nor any interpretation that specifically addresses VER plus permit. That is, property rights plus permits, right?
That's exactly right. VER historically has never involved, has never been interpreted by courts or the agency as requiring any kind of pre-deprivation exercise of property rights.
It simply historically, it was right after the statute was passed. It was interpreted that way, right?
Yes, and this is the first time the all permits test will be subject to full judicial review before this court.
Is there a stat, you mentioned that permits are mentioned in several other statutes or other statutory provisions?
In SMACRA.
Is there anyone that says VER plus permits, that is, actually uses the phrase VER plus permits?
No. The other statutory sections in SMACRA, the three other savings clauses in SMACRA that have permit-related requirements, they will... There we are. They impose additional requirements. For instance, the alluvial valley floors prohibition restricts mining on alluvial valley floors, except for those coal owners who had obtained permits to mine a year prior to SMACRA's enactment. And so in three different clauses, Congress has spoken and said, we know how to write in a permit precondition into a savings clause. And that is absent from VER, thus implying that VER does not require permits, and
well,
that it means something broader.
One of the ones I looked at said operations plus permits, right? So you wouldn't think that that's necessarily VER by itself anyway, because they're defining it differently. They're talking about property rights plus permit. Is there any place where the statute uses property rights plus permits?
SMACRA?
Yeah.
No.
So there's nothing that clearly indicates that they have quite exactly in mind the same thing and used a different set of words for it in SMACRA.
Well, in the legislative history, they clearly speak to wanting to preserve existing property rights, and this court has recognized that balance as well. 522E was enacted both to protect the environment through the surface mining prohibitions.
But the question is, what property rights? I mean, that's circular. That doesn't get you anywhere. Well, let me ask you something. Can you be a surface coal mining operation without a permit or license?
No, you cannot.
All right. Well, then isn't that dispositive? You read the language. It's subject to valid existing rights. No surface coal mining operation. You're not within the compass of that unless you have the license. I mean, that's the whole point. I don't know why this is hard that way. You're fighting against what is clear language. It says, you just said to me, which I thought was correct, you can't be a surface coal mining operation without a license. And the section that you're talking about, 522E, is talking about that kind of right. You're not in the category to assert anything if you're not a surface coal mining operation. And their regulation is perfectly consistent with that.
Well,
you stop at the wrong point in your analysis. You stop with valid existing rights. But you need to know with respect to what? And it's with respect to surface coal mining operations. If you don't have a license, you're not a surface coal mining operation.
But
and the fact that you own land under which there's coal seems to me irrelevant.
But the Secretary has said, and Congress has made clear, that 522E refers to the eligibility to enter SMACRA's regulatory scheme. And therefore, and though if you have valid existing rights, you are not prohibited from seeking a permit.
I think we're seeing it differently. I don't see what rights there are to assert if you're not yet a coal mining operation, because that's all this provision is talking about, surface coal mining operations. And you started right out agreeing with me that you are no such thing.
Under SMACRA.
Without a license.
Under, but before, but on August 3rd, 1977, there were no SMACRA surface coal mining operations because the act hadn't come into effect yet.
I'm just wondering, this interpretation is not the same as the agency's, I don't think. I thought the agency doesn't require that there be an operation.
Right.
Right, as long as there is a property interest and
yes.
good faith permits.
To get themselves within the compass of the statute.
Right. But you don't also have to have an operation, right? That's a separate.
Right. Well, there's a separate exception for existing operations.
No, no, I understand that. But the agency, one way to look at this is the agency is being very generous in saying, well, if I read the section 522E, you really should be an existing surface coal mining operation. But we'll let you own the land and you're on the way to getting it in good faith. Things are pending and you're moving along, we'll let you in too. That's a generous reading. In my view, that's a generous reading of the statute. You seem to be arguing as long as someone owns the land, that's it. And I don't know how you can get that out of this provision.
Well, no, and it's not just an ownership standard. I mean, that's very important, is that the three words, valid existing rights, ownership, and the authority to mine the coal by the method you intend. And you have to have those rights as of the day the prohibition takes effect. The existing operations exception takes care of all those operations in place that are already permitted.
When you say the authority to mine the coal, do you mean governmental authority?
No, under
or
your
ownership
deed.
Ownership
authority, under your deed. Property, Congress wanted
right.
to preserve.
You have the potential.
You have the property right to do so.
And within the deed, there was a conveyance of the coal if you want to do that too. Or you could just put a cabin up and not mine the coal, right?
Right. Well, usually we're talking about severed mineral estates here, where someone else owns the surface and you own the coal, and then the right to the coal is because the right to mine the coal, you know, is part of your property right.
Right.
And Congress wanted to preserve something beyond permitted operations by carving out VER in addition to accepting existing operations.
And again, I'm just trying to make sure I understand this. What I'm asking is, if you have such ownership, you're not required to do anything with that land, right? You just own it.
Exactly.
There's maybe a possibility of mining and maybe not. There's no guarantee. You may sit on it, right?
But it is part of my property.
I understand. I just want to make sure I'm getting this right. There's nothing that requires you to move. There's no governmental piece of paper that says you must do whatever. It's your land.
Yes.
And there's the possibility, if you're licensed, to become a surface coal mining operation. And if you're not licensed, you are not a surface coal mining operation, right? You just own that land, which one day could become a surface coal mining operation.
If I agree to subject myself to SMACRA's regulatory regime,
yeah.
Yes,
otherwise, you just sit on the land, right?
But my property interest has value in the coal that is there.
No doubt. But you're still not a surface coal mining operation until you do something more, right?
Under the definition of surface coal mining operations, SMACRA, that is right.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Your definition, which I take it is the property part of the first prong.
The ownership and authority prong, yes.
Yeah. They call it property rights demonstration. Right?
Yeah, yes.
Right, okay. Now, that's not the same as a taking prong would be, right?
Right.
So there could be situations where you have property rights demonstration, but it wouldn't be a taking to take that away. That is by regulation.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, the takings jurisprudence, because it's
sort
evolved over time.
Ad hoc.
It's ad hoc. Right. It varies. You have
right.
to, you know, depending on whether you have a Lucas test or the Penn Central test.
Right.
But there will be a subset of those who do not meet the Secretary's interpretation of good faith all permits who would qualify under under the takings tests.
And similarly, in the other way, there would be a subset of those who, where there is a property rights demonstration, that it still wouldn't be a taking. That is, even if your situation were correct, mm-hmm. that is, your interpretation were correct, there would still be some takings.
Yes.
And do you have any sense of the magnitude of that?
It would be far, I mean, under the Secretary's takings analysis, it would be far less than under the good faith all permits test.
Well, wouldn't it be, why do you think that we shouldn't avoid that interpretation? That is, why On your constitutional avoidance theory, we're trying to avoid takings.
Yes.
Why isn't the, why wouldn't you be arguing for a takings prong as being the required one rather than a property rights demonstration prong? Because, as you just said.
Okay, well, no, I'm sorry, maybe I misspoke. I'm sorry. The takings prong is a narrower subset of those who would qualify under ownership and authority, you know, because of the varying nature of takings jurisprudence.
Uh-huh.
But the ownership and authority prong, you know, gives life to all three, you know, of the words valid existing rights that and does not contemplate, and those three words on their own or anywhere in the legislative history as they're contemplated, you know, this permitting, you know, codicil that the Secretary has engrafted, you know, upon the property rights demonstration.
But you have no sense for us how big of an issue this would be, how large the takings would be?
Under ownership and authority?
Yeah.
I would have to refresh on the Secretary's takings analysis, which is in the final rule preamble. But they did say that the good faith all permits test has significant takings implications. Because it virtually, I mean, they say themselves very few people will qualify for VER under this standard. You know, because Congress intended to preserve property rights. I mean, perhaps a hypothetical would be helpful here. And I can draw facts from the case. It's Ainslie versus United States, which was a takings case brought before the claims court, where a man, Mr. Ainslie, owned a seam of coal. He died the year prior to SMACRA. He left the coal to his wife. After SMACRA is enacted, Congress enacts a historic district law that creates the surface above Ms. Ainslie's coal to be a 522E area. She has not yet, at the time that act was passed, she had not yet taken any action to exercise her rights.
It wasn't a coal mining operation.
She had not yet exercised her property rights.
She was not a coal mining operation.
Not as yet, no.
Right.
And then when she sought to do that, she was informed that she did not have valid existing rights because she did not attempt to have all permits at the time the prohibitions were in place. And the value of the property that was left to her was then worthless because there is no value in coal that cannot be mined.
And she was able to recover under the Tucker Act?
No, she brought a case under the Tucker Act, which was remanded because she had not exhausted her administrative remedies, and the agency was still going through the rulemaking, you know, the 20-year-long rulemaking that brings us to where we are today.
So we don't know how that case.
No, we do not know. I was using her facts as illustrative of, you know, of the type of situation that's created, you know, by the good faith all permits test, where without notice, property rights are extinguished.
What do you mean by not is this the due process argument that you're talking about? When you say without notice, what do you mean?
Sure, it is part of due process. It's also part of, you know, the interpretation being inherently arbitrary and capricious, where a coal owner is told in 1979 that in order to be able to exercise his right in the future, he had to have applied or attempted to apply for all permits prior to 1977. And it's just impossible to satisfy that standard.
What is your due process argument? Is this a procedural due process or substantive due process?
It is a procedural due process argument.
And it's not based on the statute, I take it. That is, you don't think the statute would violate a due process?
No.
So it's their interpretation of the statute that violated due process, right? I see. Okay.
I mean, it is.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Let me ask you just one more question.
Sure.
In the Kentucky brief, and also in the explanation of the rulemaking decision, they say that SMACRA separately requires ownership and the rights to extract coal in a particular way under 1257, and therefore it would be duplicative. Could you explain what your answer to that argument is? I'm accurately describing the government's argument.
Yes.
Right?
No, their argument does not consider the value of the word existing. They're arguing that there would be no additional protections more than any other SMACRA permit applicant has to go through, but that is not true. If I obtain a deed to coal in the early 1970s, and my deed does not allow surface mining, but I obtain that right, I buy that right to surface mine from the owner after SMACRA's enactment. But the land has already come under 522E. I am barred under the ownership and authority standard from mining because I did not have that ownership.
So only original owners can.
Well, and with the authority.
I
I did not have the authority to mine by surface mining at the time the prohibition came into effect.
It's only original owners who have got permits, et cetera, under the government's position, that is before 1977, who would be able to operate?
Those who have the ownership and the authority to mine by the intended method prior to 1977.
And they can't sell that interest.
No, VER is transferable.
Yeah, it
is. VER is transferable.
So I'm not following that.
It was that by the at the time the prohibitions came into place, mm-hmm. I need to have both ownership and the authority. You can purchase authority later, and if I'm on a non-522E land, I can purchase that right to surface mine today and file
That's
my permit
true.
Application
you buy
tomorrow.
Property all the time. I mean, it's this great deal of property that's subject to limitations. When someone buys property, they have to look to see whether there's an easement, a limitation. You can't put a retail high-rise any place you want. There may be right. limitations. And you may say, but that I had that in mind to do. And that's why I bought the property. And people say, well, you should have checked the law first.
Well, and that's the whole point is that prior to 1977, people couldn't check the law. There was no law to check. And OS Secretary is telling them after SMACRA's enactment that there are steps they had to have taken with respect to their property that they had no knowledge that they were going to have to do prior to SMACRA's enactment or extinguish the value of their coal.
If that's actually if that really is a taking, then you get compensation, for that under the Tucker Act.
But Congress specifically indicated in the legislative history, and this court has recognized that Congress did not intend to cause takings through 522E. In NWF v. Hodel, this court said that's how 522E is to be construed. Congress drafted 522E to avoid infringement of existing property rights.
Then why isn't the right rule a takings rule? Why is the right rule a property rule?
Because
that's all there was to it.
Because the ownership and authority rule preserves existing property rights that may not survive under a takings rule because of because of the difficulty in applying the taking standard to each situation.
I just want to read to you the Kentucky Resources Council's argument that I was trying to understand your answer to. They say SMACRA separately requires every applicant for a mining permit to establish one, ownership of the coal reserve, and two, right to extract by the particular method.
Yes.
And they cite 1257B2 and B9.
Yes.
So what's the answer to that?
And so the answer is that ignores the timing of when you had that authority to mine. On non-522E lands, you can acquire that authority to land at any time.
So that's the difference. One has to be before 1977.
Or at the time the prohibitions take effect, yes. And that is a meaningful limitation, as demonstrated by the Paulino and the West Virginia-Pittsburgh coal cases. I would like to reserve some time for rebuttal. That's okay.
May it please the Court, I'm Katie Kovacs for the United States. Counsel for the interveners, Walton Morris, asked me to express his regret at not being able to attend the argument today due to a conflict with another argument in the Fourth Circuit.
So you'll be able to answer that answer then.
Yes, I'm going to jump right into your last question, which is one of the two basic problems with the Mining Association's interpretation is one that it, as Your Honor was just asking, it renders the VER exception redundant, and two, it renders much of Section 522E entirely ineffective. Now, what Ms. Nathanson just said, in their briefs, the Mining Association has espoused the first sentence of the regulatory definition of VER, which is in the appendix to the blue brief. Subsection A, the first part of the definition, is the property rights demonstration, which requires a person claiming VER to show that some legally binding document, a lease or a deed, gives them or a predecessor in interest a right to mine using a certain method. They have espoused that section of the definition in their briefs, or a predecessor in interest. That entirely negates the explanation that Ms. Nathanson just tried to give. So if anybody owned the right to mine, I think this is what Judge Edwards was saying earlier, that basically under their interpretation, whoever owns the coal can mine it. There's no timing issue. So it is entirely redundant with Section 1257B9 because anybody who applies for a SMACRA permit has to show that they own the right to mine using a certain method. There's no timing issue here because their definition even says it's not just the person in 1997 who needs to have that right. It's anybody in the chain of title could have had that right. So even those people who acquire the surface rights after the fact are still covered. Does that make sense?
I'm sure it does, but I'm not getting it.
Okay.
Well, let's just try again.
Their interpretation of the statute is basically that first section of the regulation.
Let me put it another way around. They say, you say you have a property rights demonstration which requires the rights exist before 1977. Leave out the transferring part for a second, that the rights exist before, in this case, 1977.
Somebody owned the right before 1977.
Right. And the permit.
Yeah, plus a permit, right? That's your...
No, you didn't have to have a permit. You had to have a right to mine under state law and some good faith effort to make use of that right, but you expressly did not have to have a permit.
Yeah, good faith or a permit. I understand. I'm trying to use this in some shorthand just for the purposes mm-hmm. of this. And in the announcement of the regulation, you say that if we didn't add the permit to this, that is, or the good faith, I'm going to just call it permit for the moment. If we didn't add the permit, it would be duplicative of 1257.
Correct.
They say, well, 1257, it's not duplicative of 1257 because 1257 lets you get the rights anytime, that is the ownership rights anytime.
Correct.
So this is a different kind of property right because it's limited to ones before a certain time plus permits.
Right.
So that there's a little bit of apples and oranges, but it's not true to say that if we eliminated the permit standard, there would be nothing more to this regulation. Actually, there would be something more to this regulation than there is in 1257, namely the 1977 requirement.
It's actually the same, though, because of that language about a predecessor and interest. So that element of that first sentence, which says either the claimant or a predecessor in interest, basically eliminates the time factor.
So 1257
requires anybody applying for a permit to show that they have a deed or a lease and the right under state law.
Applying for a permit within these designated areas or anywhere?
Anywhere.
But
any SMACRA permit.
Right,
1257 is the general.
I understand. Mm-hmm. A SMACRA permit applies only to these limited areas, like the wilderness, like the national parks. It applies anywhere, right? So if it applies anywhere, you can get property rights with the right to surface mine that didn't exist before 1977, that nobody had before 1977. Is that right or wrong?
I guess it's theoretically possible.
Well, if it's not
I'm not sure that...
Well, if it's not a reserved area, if it's not an area that Congress has set aside with the specific rules,
right.
Then you still have to get permits to do this, and you still have to have the rights to extract, but you don't have to have obtained them before the statutory designation occurred.
Right, but somebody owned the coal. I mean, every bit of the...
They may not have yet owned the extraction right. That is, the right to do it by surface mining.
Well, no, I think anybody who owns a subsurface estate owns the right to mine it. The question, this
by
a certain method,
right.
Is a question of that refers to state law limitations on the type of mining operation that's permitted, how exactly you can extract the coal. It's not a matter of whether you can extract the coal, it's how you can extract
it. No, I appreciate that, but under 1257A, it looks, or B, or whatever this is, under 1257, it looks B, I guess, it looks like you can obtain this right to use a certain method later, even if no one ever had that right before.
Again, I think it's theoretically possible, but that's not actually the way it works. I mean, if you own land in West Virginia, you own the surface estate and the subsurface estate. You have the right, if there's coal under that land, to mine it.
Well, if somebody else owns the subsurface,
if it's been severed, then the question of how they're allowed to get at that coal is, under SMACRA and very clearly stated in the legislative history, a matter of state law.
So you think that...
But that's a matter of method.
The fact is that this subsection A of your regulation applies actually to everybody.
Yeah, there's actually no distinction. That reference to the predecessor and interest erases the time component and does make it redundant. But there's another problem. I mean,
I'm trying to identify one problem mm-hmm. at a time. There's no reference to the predecessor estate in 1257, but you're saying that it's applied?
No, what I'm saying is that the two end up meaning exactly the same thing because the regulation allows the ownership interest or the right to mine to have been owned at any point in time. So it erases the time component and makes their interpretation of VER redundant of 1257.
Now I have to ask some questions because I'm not sure. What,
mm-hmm. Still not sure, but maybe this will
I don't know. As of August 377, with respect to a disputed piece of property, anyone who's now about to argue it has to show that either I or my predecessor in interest had the ownership and the permits.
No.
Wait, let me finish the question first. On August 3, 1977.
Right.
And if they were not there then.
Or good faith.
Or the good faith. Or good faith effort was being made back then. And if they can't show that, they're out of luck.
And the error in the question.
Wait, is that right? Is that your view?
No. So the error in the question is you don't have to have had permits. You have to have owned a property right to coal, and you have to have made some good faith effort to exercise that property right, basically. Maybe I'm quibbling, but the reason it doesn't require that you have obtained permits, you have
either
to have made a good faith effort to obtain permits.
Had all relevant permits or made a good faith effort
right,
to
that's
secure
exactly
those
right.
permits as of the 77 date.
Exactly right. Yes. And the reason I quibble is because I think because the Mining Association continually refers to this as the all permits standard. It's not an all permits standard.
No. I understand the two prongs, but I want to make sure you say there's no time. There is a time component, because if someone owned it, had neither a permit or was not making any good faith efforts to get a permit, and then sells it in 1990, and the coal's still under there, it's selling something that is worth less than it might otherwise be worth if someone could mine that coal. But they're not going to be able to mine that coal. The buyer is out of luck.
Well, not necessarily. And this goes back to the question about takings, actually, that this interpretation, the good faith all permits standard, has been part of the federal interpretation of VER for about 24 years.
I'm not saying whether it's good or bad. I'm just trying to make sure I understand.
Yeah.
A person buying in 1990 who cannot show either that the predecessor in interest from whom he or she is buying had a permit or had making a good faith effort, they're out of luck. They've bought something. They cannot buy something and say, but I have coal mining rights.
They're out of luck with regard to the good faith all permit standard. But it's important, I think, critical to note that there are a lot of other ways to get at that coal. Mm-hmm. First, you can satisfy the needed for an adjacent standard. There's a separate standard for roads. And as a practical matter and as a matter of statutory interpretation, anybody who doesn't get a VER determination can get a compatibility determination or a waiver. And that's why in the 24 years, this standard has been part of the federal interpretation of VER.
So you're saying this doesn't matter that much?
Well, actually, in a sense.
I'm a little unclear about that. The brief seems to argue both that we need this to protect the environment and it doesn't affect anybody.
Well, it doesn't cause takings because there are these other alternatives. So in the 24 years it's been in effect, the United States has never paid just compensation for an application of this rule, and I don't think any state has either. I don't know that there's ever been a due process claim as a result of the application of this rule.
In terms of the effect on people who owned the coal before, does it have a big effect or a little effect?
Well, OSM did a in-depth analysis of this, as the court is well aware, the environmental impacts and the economic impacts, and determined that this rule, in conjunction with the subsidence regulation that this court upheld several years ago in the Citizens Coal Council case, would have minimal economic impact.
So it both has a big effect and a minimal effect.
Well, I think OSM's, here's the...
How is it that you need it desperately to protect the environment, but it has only the most negligible impact on the people who want to use the coal?
Economically, it has very little impact because there are other exceptions. And as a practical matter, there's very little impact on economically viable coal seams is part of what's going on in the final economic analysis, which the court has a copy of. It's a very complicated analysis, but part of the reason the agency determined it wouldn't have a big economic impact was because the coal that becomes inaccessible under this combination of the subsidence rule and the VER rule is not actually economically terribly viable.
So if that's the case, imagine that part of the rule were struck. I'm not saying we're going to do that. I just want you to hypothesize. Would that have a big effect on the environment?
It would allow mining of other areas.
You still have the subsidence rules.
So it could.
All these other rules.
Yeah. I mean, OSM determined that this was the environmentally preferred alternative, again, in combination with the subsidence rule. And the analysis is co-joined for the two because they're so interactive. Another reason OSM felt somewhat constrained about what interpretation to adopt is, as I was quibbling with Judge Edwards before, we know that VER can't require the claimant to have all of his permits because there's already an exception for existing operations, which is defined in Section 761.12 of the regulations as an operation that has all of its permits. So that can't be VER.
Over that one, Judge Edwards was asking, if you read subsection E, he was saying that one interpretation, maybe the one he thought was the most clear, was that it applies to surface coal mining operations only to begin with. That is, first of all, you have to be a surface coal mining operation. I didn't read that as being the government's interpretation.
No, I don't think we do read it that way. I think
I don't know how you can't, because that's all the section's talking about.
Yeah, I think
you
we read it as a prerequisite.
Valid existing right, unless the statutory language is talking about, you know, to say the words valid existing rights is to say nothing. With respect to whom are we speaking?
Right.
We're not talking about corn growers. We're not talking about.
Yeah.
And we're talking about surface coal mining operations.
Yeah, I think it's definitely a legitimate reading of this murky, always murky statute. The agency reads this provision 522E essentially to prohibit surface coal mining, not underground mining, mind you, and that goes back to the subsidence rule from the CCC case. You can mine underground in 522E areas. It prohibits surface coal mining operations except for existing operations and those who own valid existing rights. And the problem with the mining association's interpretation is twofold. One, we've been discussing.
You're not actually making the argument that is limited to operations.
No, you don't have a surface coal mining operation until you have a SMACRA permit.
Before SMACRA, then, must
I think the agency reads this as a prerequisite. And as a practical matter, the way the process works, if you own the coal, you go into OSM and say, I want a VER determination. And they either give you a positive or a negative. If they say, no, you don't own VER, then you go for a compatibility determination or you try to get a waiver. And then you go and get your SMACRA permit. So that's as a practical matter, the way the process works, which reflects the agency's interpretation of the statute. So the second problem with their interpretation of the statute is that it renders much of 522E ineffective because it basically holds whoever owns the coal can mine it, which I think Judge Edwards said earlier on. And the problem then is, for example, the areas covered by subsections E4 and E5, which is road right-of-ways and buffer zones underneath houses and schools and cemeteries and so on. Under their interpretation, whoever owns the coal can mine it, period. 522E has no impact in those areas. So their interpretation is actually at odds with the primary purpose of Section 522E as reflected in the statute itself and clearly reflected in the legislative history.
Can you tell me which section you're talking about? You're talking about 3? 4 within 100 feet of the outside right of way of a public road. So
definitely 4 and 5. Is it 3? That's
4 doesn't say. Well, let's look at 5. It's got fewer words. Within 300 feet of an occupied dwelling.
Yeah. So under private land, basically, anyone who owns the coal can mine it. And Section 522E's prohibition is basically meaningless. So the exception that they identified in their brief to that rule was new federal coal leases, which I agree is an exception. It would still, 522E would still bar the federal government from giving new federal coal leases. But I think under their interpretation, that's about all it would do. So their interpretation renders the statute, much of the statute, ineffective, and it conflicts with the primary purpose of 522E.
I'm sorry, I need you to go a little slower on this.
Okay.
So E says, after 1977 and subject to valid existing rights, no surface coal mining operation shall be permitted. And then, for example, 5 says, within 300 feet from any occupied dwelling.
Right.
Right. So in order to do it within 300 feet from any occupied dwelling, it has to be, if they wanted to do it, you'd have to have a valid existing right.
Right.
So I'm not.
And under their interpretation,
right,
all that means is you have a deed to the coal.
Right. So why does that make sense? I appreciate it's not the one you want, and maybe the one you think is most reasonable, but why do you think it's?
Because then 522E5 doesn't actually prohibit anything, because somebody owns the coal underlying every house in West Virginia.
Well,
whoever owns the coal can mine it.
Well, they may own the coal, but they may not have a right to surface mine it.
And that's again, somebody has the right to mine the coal. Whoever owns the coal.
Maybe it's the people living in the house.
And it could be that they have the surface right, but the person who owns the coal then has the right to underground mine it.
Well,
so that reference
about,
to
this is not about underground mining. We're talking at this point about the surface coal mining, right?
So right.
People who own the coal under the ground, I don't know, under West Virginia law, may not have the right to surface mine it.
Right, but somebody owns that right.
Yeah.
And under the definition in the regulation that they have espoused, it doesn't matter who owned it when, because of
right,
that predecessor and interest language.
Who else could have the right to surface mine? Why do you say there's surface rights for everybody?
Well, either the owner of the surface estate or the owner of the mineral estate.
Does the owner of a surface estate have the right to surface mine coal when he doesn't own any coal?
No.
So,
no, I get the good point.
Yes, not.
Good point. Yeah.
Right.
So, but again, it doesn't matter if when the owner of the coal obtains the right to access it from the surface because of the language in the regulation that they have espoused that says predecessor and interest. So
there is no, an example you're giving where the rights have been severed. Somebody owns the coal underneath, somebody owns the land. There's nothing to transfer at this point. You can transfer them separately, but no one in 1977 under that example has the right to do surface mining.
If state law didn't allow access through the surface.
Right. And there's, you know, one of these cases is just about exactly that.
I suppose that is a theoretical possibility, yeah. The problem is then, again, their interpretation still renders the statute ineffective in a large portion of situations, and it runs contrary to Congress's stated purpose in enacting 522E, which was to protect certain areas for environmental and public safety reasons. So we have a range of what VER might mean. We know it can't just be a property right, and we know it can't be that you need all your permits. OSM chose a point somewhere along that continuum at the good faith all permits test and the needed for an adjacent standard and the separate standard for roads as the place to balance these competing interests of 522E, the environmental and public safety interests against the public property, the private property interests. If I could engage the court for just another minute, I wanted to quickly address Ms. Nathanson's reference to the use of VER in other statutes. I think that argument is directly contrary to the Supreme Court's recent decision in Duke Energy, where the Supreme.
Is your 28J letter?
This is the 28J letter.
We have the letter, unless you're going
to. The term VER, although it's been used hundreds of times, has not been defined in a regulation. It has come to mean a number of different things. In ANCSA, the Alaska case, it means legitimate expectations.
We have this.
Thank you very much, Your Honor, for the time.
And you want some? How much rebuttal time is left? All right, we'll give you 2 minutes.
Oh, thank you very much, Your Honor. I just wanted to briefly point out that I wanted to point the court to the agency's economic analysis, which lays out the acreages that will be impacted, that could be impacted under the ownership and authority standard, while Ms. Kovacs points that this will have, that the ownership and authority standard will have these broad and dramatic impacts. The agency's economic analysis shows 1,300 acres out of the 10 million coal-bearing acres that are forever protected under 522E, 1,300 acres would be eligible to seek a SMACRA permit under the ownership and authority standard.
Could you say a word about her reconciliation of, well, argument about 1257 and why your argument about this?
Again, yes. I mean, it's coming down to the issue of timing. Let's look to a severed mineral estate in West Virginia. I own the surface. Someone else owns the coal. The deed is similar to the deed in Paulino, which only allows extraction of the coal via underground methods. And 1977 SMACRA is enacted. That coal owner cannot extract the coal via surface methods. Their deed does not allow it. They would have to purchase that from me, the surface owner.
And the difference under 1257?
Well, the difference under 1257, well, it's a dwelling. I mean, it is a 522E area. I mean, 1257 applies to all SMACRA lands. So we're talking about 522E lands or non-522E lands. If I'm the surface owner of a non-522E land, he can purchase that right to surface from me at any time in the future and get his permit.
And if it's an E land, you can't do that.
Exactly. He did not have that right to surface mine as of 1977 or whenever the land became subject to the prohibitions, and therefore he is barred. He is ineligible from seeking a SMACRA permit.
Right. Okay. I mean, and someone who was buying it on the assumption you could get the surface mining would have made a bad deal.
On the prior to SMACRA's enactment.
You're saying much later on it can't be sold. Yeah, well, why would anyone buy it on the assumption that you could have surface mining if it's clear under the law that you can't?
Well, prior to 1977, it was not clear under the law. And that's the point, that the coal owners did not know. They would have to have anticipated that SMACRA would be enacted, that there would be these prohibitions, that the secretary would not honor valid existing rights as meaning property rights rather than the exercise of rights, and that they would have had to race to agencies to obtain permits before SMACRA's enactment.
But that's true of any kind of land use regulation that provides just compensation if there's a taking but doesn't otherwise protect existing rights, isn't it?
And in this statute, we have clear congressional intent and legislative history to preserve existing rights and avoid takings, as this court recognized in SMACRA.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.